This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Tonight we'll bring you the latest state and regional news on COVID-19, and then we'll hear from one guest, Dr. Jacob Glanville, a scientist who says he's found a possible cure for the virus. Don't forget, we want you to drive this coverage. Are there stories you want to hear and haven't yet? Give us a call, 433-9216. That's 433-9216. And you can always reach us on our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, April 2nd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Now, that's state and regional news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The California Department of Public Health last reported a total of 8,155 cases of COVID-19 in the state and 171 deaths. The number of cases increased by more than 17% from the prior day. According to the figures, 21 Californians died of the ailment over the 24 hours ending at 10 a.m. Wednesday. Statewide, officials report more than 1,400 people in intensive care suffering respiratory distress. Just under half of those cases are considered suspected COVID-19. Men appear slightly more susceptible, making up a bit more than 53% of confirmed cases in California. According to county health officials, there are now 61 active cases in the North State, 22 in Yuba, 14 in Sutter, 10 in Butte County, 7 in Shasta, 3 in Siskiyou, 2 in Glenn, and 1 each in Colusa, Plumas, and Tehama. There are no reported cases in Lassen or Trinity counties. The most significant increases in reports of positive test results have been from Yuba and Sutter counties. In other news, state public health officials today suggested for the first time that all members of the public wear some sort of face covering when outside. Quote, face coverings could provide some additional protection against COVID-19, but Californians should not have a false sense of security if they choose to wear them. The words of California Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Mark Ghaly. Officials say members of the public should eschew N95 and surgical masks, making them more available for medical professionals. Officials insist people continue observing hand washing and social distancing protocols. While anything other than an N95 mask isn't fully effective, authorities now seem to recommend that something is better than nothing. Meanwhile, state prison officials reported 8 confirmed cases among inmates and 27 among guards and other employees, an increase of 2 over yesterday. It's official. School's out for summer. Governor Gavin Newsom late yesterday ordered the closure of all school campuses for the remainder of the school year, a move generally expected. Education will continue through online and distance learning. Meanwhile, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond announced a deal with state university systems to ease certain graduation requirements for high school students. Some districts have shifted to pass-fail or credit-no credit for required courses because of the coronavirus. Officials are working on a way to count such grades without damaging a student's grade point average. Also yesterday, Newsom announced he was tapping the state's economic reserves to the tune of $1.3 billion as a source of emergency spending. State officials expect Washington to reimburse California for coronavirus-related expenses. Those that fall behind in their water bills won't lose their utility service. Today, Newsom directed the State Water Resources Control Board to issue guidelines to the water systems it regulates. The order remains in effect until the official state of emergency expires. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Today, we're taking the entire 30 minutes of this show to hear from a scientist who says he might have found a potential cure for COVID-19. Dr. Jacob Glanville runs the biotech company Distributed Bio in the Bay Area. If his name sounds familiar, it's likely from the Netflix documentary series called Pandemic. It just came out right before the pandemic we're living in January. To hear about how this potential cure would work and how it was discovered, NSPR's Blue Dot host and science correspondent Dave Schlom spoke with Dr. Glanville yesterday. He started the conversation around the doctor's title, asking, what is a computational immunoengineer?
A computational immunoengineer is an immunologist that uses math and computers to engineer immune proteins as drugs. The most common one would be an antibody, and we do a lot of antibody engineering. But I would also classify people that are developing new types of engineered vaccines as immunoengineers, and also people that are engineering T cells through CAR T or other methods as treatments for cancer and other disorders as immunoengineers.
And you started out with a big pharmaceutical company, right? And then you developed this company yourself. Why'd you do that?
Yeah, so I worked at Pfizer for 4 years after I graduated my undergraduate from UC Berkeley. And at Pfizer, I was working on antibody discovery and engineering. But ultimately, I left Pfizer because they let me get me promoted 4 times in a row, and I didn't think they were going to do it a fifth time. I was interested in applying to a PhD program in computational and systems immunology at Stanford, which I ended up getting into. And then I also had this idea for making even more kind of hardcore or far-reaching antibody discovery technologies. And so I founded my own company, applied for the PhD program, and I figured one of the two would fail. So I was just like, I'll try two things and one will work. And instead, both worked out. So I just didn't sleep a lot for the next 5 years, but we were able to grow a robust portfolio of like 50 different companies that work with us now, and we engineer their medicines for them. And in the academic wing, I ended up graduating in 2017. So I ended up getting that PhD at the same time.
Well, congratulations, Dr. Glanville.
Thank you very much.
And you came to our attention in the Netflix documentary Pandemic, which came around, I think, in January. And you were featured in there as trying to develop a universal influenza vaccine. What I'd like to ask you, though, is when did this pandemic, the COVID-19, when did it first get on your radar?
Yeah, so that's kind of a crazy story. We were just talking about this morning with my wife and I. At the beginning of this year, I remember kind of the first conversation I had about it, probably like everyone else, it sort of seemed very far away. My wife and I were just speculating on how it seemed unlikely that snakes were actually where the virus originally came from. And I remember at the time that the Netflix documentary was coming out, which is around January 22nd, my team was getting all excited about the Netflix documentary. And I told them all, like, guys, just calm down. There's 10,000 things on Netflix. Nobody's going to even know that our docuseries is up there. And instead, it came out right around the time that this outbreak in Wuhan started becoming more severe. And so because the Netflix documentary was called Pandemic, How to Prevent an Outbreak, it ended up being on the front page of Netflix's website everywhere around the world. And so we suddenly got a whole bunch of attention for our documentary. But then, of course, we were getting increasingly alarmed by what was going on in Wuhan. The next week after the documentary series came out, I actually flew out to Washington, D.C. to attend something called the BioThreats meeting. And I had scheduled meetings with BARDA and DARPA.
And explain what those are.
Oh, yeah. So those are two different arms of the government that are tasked with developing biotechnology agents, so medicines that could potentially rapidly be developed to treat outbreaks. So I went over there to the BioThreats meeting, and Fauci was presenting, and already Fauci was concerned that the outbreak was no longer going to be containable. He's a smart guy, and so he had run his numbers, and he was like, this is already a pretty serious problem that we need to start thinking about here in the United States. And BARDA had canceled the meeting with me because they needed to focus on the new coronavirus. So I was planning to meet with them about other things. And then DARPA had asked, they met with me, but they were like, hey, can you change what we're talking about to, instead of discussing hantavirus and Lassa virus, can we just talk about the novel coronavirus? And so I walked out of that meeting with Fauci. I set up a plan, I was proposal on how we would go create antibodies against the novel coronavirus extremely quickly. Because that's why they really were bringing me out, as they were evaluating my technologies as a method for producing super fast antibodies against a novel outbreak. And suddenly what was going to be sort of a trial run against Hanta or Lassa virus became a very real scenario when we're talking about the current outbreak. And so I had that meeting with them, but lobbyists from a couple other bigger companies than mine had gotten there first. So they said, look, we're interested in this, but we'll let you know once we get some more money released. And so I left the meeting without money, but at that point, I'd already kind of decided that we should go attack the problem anyway. So I contacted Sharad Dariakia and Jack Wang on my team, and I set them up with the marching orders to start producing our antibody therapeutics against the novel virus.
And I want you to explain to our listeners what the difference is between vaccines, because everybody's, you know, hoping for a vaccine as soon as possible, and a therapeutic.
Sure. So both are good, and they are quite different. So with a vaccine, what you're doing is you've got a syringe, and you've got a bunch of little bits of the virus in the syringe. And there's various ways you can do that. But bottom line, what you're doing is injecting the person with pieces of the virus. And then their body is going to have some time to produce an immune response against those pieces. Then eventually they'll produce a bunch of protective antibodies. That could take 6 or 7 or even 8 weeks, but eventually they're going to have a whole bunch of antibodies in their body. So if they were ever actually exposed to the real virus, they'd have those antibodies already ready to defend themselves. That's great. They're cheap to produce. You don't require a lot of material. It's just a little shot in the arm. So they're fantastic technologies. But here, I had some concerns about that being our only solution. The main one was it takes a long time to run vaccine studies because you have to go give them to a bunch of healthy people. And then you have to wait a long time for them to develop immunity. And you have to wait even longer to see whether they get sick or not. You can't give a vaccine to someone who's already sick because within 5 to 10 days, that person's going to recover or you know, they're going to die. And so the vaccine hasn't had time to take effect during that period. And so the studies are quite slow. The other problem with vaccines is that they rely on your immune system doing its job of creating the antibodies in response to the vaccine. And so if you're immunocompromised or you're elderly, your immune system often doesn't work that well. And unfortunately, those are the populations that are most at risk because of the novel coronavirus. So for those reasons, you want this alternative technology, which is an antibody therapeutic. And what that is that it's instead of giving you pieces of the virus and waiting for your body to produce antibodies, you have a syringe that skips the middleman. It's just as full of antibodies. You inject it into that person and they immediately have those antibodies in their body within like 20 minutes. And that would work on everybody basically the same way. It doesn't matter if they're immunocompromised or they're elderly. The downside is that it's more expensive. And it won't last as long as a vaccine. A vaccine could give you at least a year of protection. And it might give you 5 years, whereas antibodies will last about 8 weeks in your blood. But the good news is you can give them to patients and it will work immediately. So you can treat it like an antiviral. You could also give it to the elderly to protect them before they ever got sick or to hospital staff as a means of making sure that they can work in a high risk environment without getting infected. And the benefit of being able to give it to patients means that you can run these very fast studies. So instead of having to wait for months for the vaccine to take effect and then months to see whether they get sick or not, you can go in and within 10 days, you'll have your outcome on hundreds of patients receiving the antibody. So you know very quickly whether it's effective medicine, which means you can give it out to more people faster.
I'm wondering, are the coronaviruses like this novel coronavirus, COVID-19, are they any more difficult or different to develop treatments and vaccines for than influenza?
Well, in some respects, they're easier. And in some respects, they're harder. So the things that make it easier is that so far, it looks like the current coronavirus is not mutating as quickly as influenza does. There are some mutations occurring over the globe, but so far, it seems like it mutates a little slower. The other advantage of the coronavirus is that it has this, the biology of the coronavirus is such that if you were, imagine you were looking at one through a microscope, a very strong microscope, it would look like a crown. That's why they call it corona. And it's got these spikes. And if you were to zoom into one of those spikes, it would have these three little bobbles hanging off. And they're called the receptor binding domains. And those little bobbles, they go, and when the virus is in your lungs, it'll stick onto your cell, and then they pop open, and then the virus is able to infect. So those little bobbles are actually pretty easy for us in biotechnology to manipulate. They're called the receptor binding domain. And they're basically the same general shape between SARS and MERS and the novel coronavirus. And so the research that people had done 18, 20 years ago on SARS gave us a lot of good information on how we could potentially work with this novel coronavirus. And that's why companies like Moderna have been able to, and others have been able to produce vaccines quite quickly. So that's all the good news. On the flip side, there's something a little bit more dangerous about the coronaviruses, and that is that they have this thing called antibody-dependent enhancement. And that means that under some circumstances, producing a bad response against immune response against the coronavirus is worse than having no response at all. So as an example, people have made vaccines against very distant coronaviruses in chickens, and they work great. But in a more recent study, people tried to make a vaccine for a different type of coronavirus in cats. And the cats who received the coronavirus vaccine were much worse off, got much more sick, and were prone towards dying when exposed. And it was because these weak antibodies go and bind, and through incompletely understood reasons, they bind the wrong way. And so they actually make the virus be able to infect immune cells or otherwise be more virulent. And so that's part of the reason why we're looking here at the coronavirus. We need to make sure that our vaccines don't just respond, but they respond really well, because we want to be like the chickens and not like the cats.
You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. When we return, more with Dr. Jacob Glanville and NSPR's Dave Schlohm. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Today we're hearing from Dr. Jacob Glanville, a computational immunoengineer who has potentially found a cure for COVID-19. He was interviewed by NSPR's host of Blue Dot and science correspondent Dave Schlohm yesterday. Let's get back to their conversation.
Looking at your website and researching you, you have these amazing, powerful technological tools at your disposal. Like, for example, I saw a superhuman 2.0 antibody library. Tell me about what is that?
Yeah, so we work in the golden age of biotechnology right now, and we've been able to benefit from some really cool technologies people have built over the last 30 years. And on top of it, we've benefited from having high throughput data acquisition and cool algorithms to help us interpret the data and the Amazon cloud to give us limitless computational power to analyze the data. So superhuman, this was a technology that I developed in my lab where we have a test tube. And if you were to look inside that test tube very carefully, you would find 76 billion different human antibodies. And every one of those antibodies has the DNA instructions for that antibody attached to it. And we use a technology called phage display, which basically is that we have a virus that infects bacteria. We've engineered part of its genome to contain the ability, the instructions for making a single human antibody. And that antibody ends up getting produced on its surface. And so in effect, you have an antibody with a little virus attached to it with the genetic instructions. And there's 76 billion of them in that test tube, and they're all different. So if I have a company come to me and says, hey, Jake, I want to produce an antibody that binds a plaque in the brain or it binds a surface of a bacteria, I can take that plaque or that bacteria, I can swish it around that test tube and pull out all the antibodies that bind to it. And then because the virus particle is attached, I can pull out its genome and read the genetic instructions of making a never-ending supply of that antibody. So it's called a library. It's a library of 76 billion antibodies, which is basically enough that no matter what target drug target anybody ever wants to make an antibody against, I can just go search into that infinite pool of antibodies and fish one out quite quickly.
Wow. Well, what everybody wants to know, I'm sure, listening to this, is how far along are you? How close are you to developing this therapeutic?
Yeah, so we had a pretty awesome breakthrough over the weekend. So I'll tell you the major advance, but then I'm also going to tell you the sobering set of things that still need to happen next. So in January, while I was at the BioThreats meeting, after seeing what was going on with Fauci, I got worried. So I came back, I talked with DARPA, and I decided I'm just going to move forward with our program. And partially it was because I thought there was a risk that we might need a medicine quickly, partially because I knew I had a technology and I wanted to show to the government and the world that my technology could produce antibodies ultra fast against a new outbreak. And so what we did is we used that superhuman technology. A guy named Jack Wang in my lab engineered that little bobble, the receptor binding domain, from the virus in our lab, and then we could use that to fish around in those tubes to come up with binders. What we also did is we went back to almost 20 years ago when we found these five antibodies that were really well studied after the SARS outbreak. They bound to SARS, they would block up the virus, they would neutralize it so it wouldn't be able to infect cells, and they would protect animals. So if SARS ever came back, those five antibodies would be great drugs. So what I did is we realized that the old SARS and the new coronavirus are cousins. They've mutated somewhat compared to each other, but they're not totally different. And so we used a technology called Tumblr to make billions of versions of slightly mutated versions of those original five antibodies against SARS and basically evolve them to go from recognizing SARS to rapidly recognizing the new coronavirus. We tried five different antibodies because we knew that was going to be challenging. And we were pretty excited over the weekend to find out that we succeeded on all five of those antibodies, as well as Superhuman, in creating panels of ultra high affinity antibodies that would directly block the infectivity of the novel coronavirus. So that's the good news, is that we now have therapeutics. These are candidate therapeutics. These things could be given to a patient and they would neutralize the virus so it couldn't infect your cells anymore. The tough work that is still ahead is that those antibodies need to be tested for safety. So they need to be tested on tissue slices from people. They need to be tested in, sorry, my kid's talking and crying.
You know what? We're all dealing with that nowadays because we're all working from home.
That's all right. Okay, good.
Don't worry about it.
We need to do a neutralization test. So we're talking with an arm of the military to run that for us. And we're also talking with an academic partner that goes with the Gates Foundation to basically mix it with the virus and see how potently it neutralizes the new virus. And we also need to go through something called GMP manufacture, which is normally a super time-consuming process that could take 9 months. We are working with groups that could go much faster than that. And we're still trying to finalize which group we work with that could produce a product of sufficiently high quality that it's safe to administer to humans. That's what the GMP process is. Once you do that, and that can take, the fastest groups we're talking to think they can do that in 2 to 3 months. That's very fast. So we'll see where we land. After that, we need to do a phase 1/2 study. So this is a human study where you give the drug to a large number of patients. And then within 5 to 10 days, you have your outcomes largely collected. It'll take a little longer than that because you don't dose everybody on the first day. But pretty quickly, you'd find out whether it was efficacious or not. You're able to combine phase 1 and phase 2. Normally, you split those two apart, but in emergencies like this or in cancer research, they often combine those two because they're basically like, if you're going to find out safety from phase 1, which is what normally happens there, you might as well also learn whether it works and just spend more money and test more subjects right in phase 1. At that point, assuming all looks good, it's safe and it's helpful, then you could start releasing the drug to hundreds of thousands or even millions of people under compassionate use or expanded access protocols. But that would require that you have a lot of material available, which means a government or some other large funding entity should pay for that production. So you add all that stuff up, and we're talking about it being September at the earliest that I can contemplate releasing that. And that requires that red tape gets chopped up pretty quickly and getting out of our way, and that it requires that GMP manufacture runs pretty smooth.
Well, I know there's, you know, tremendous amount of pressure at the federal level to come up with these therapeutics. So I would hope that red tape will get cut as fast as possible.
We're going to continue applying the same kind of creative problem solving that we applied to the engineering to take what normally would be a year-long thing and turn that into, like, you know, we basically did it in 9 weeks. And we're going to keep applying those sorts of creative concepts to getting GMP moved forward quickly, getting the red tape out of the way. If I have to hire a lobbyist to hang outside the person at the FDA with donuts to, like, help get that stuff moved forward as quickly as possible, I'll do it. This is a roller coaster because we were working on this project, and Sherrod and Jack are really the heroes here because they worked on this tirelessly while we were also we serve 40 other clients. We have a whole bunch of pharmaceutical companies we do antibody discovery with. And so in February, they were working on this stuff as well as the other stuff in the day job. And it got more intense as the number of infections grew. And then we started seeing spreading happening out of China into other countries, and Fauci was being proven correct. And then, you know, we had this pretty crazy day where I was going actually to go up and show up on one of the major radio or television channels. And that's when the White House gave their press announcement about it being a national emergency. And then around the same time, California, by the time I got back to the office, California, or at least the seven counties around San Francisco, had declared that there was going to be a shelter in place ordinance. And so I'm going into my offices and there's, like, the chief of the police on TV telling everyone how to shelter in place. And then the other company in our building had to shut down because they had a COVID-19 case in their other site, but they shut down both sites and they were basically scrubbing the building. So at that point, I really thought we were going to lose the project as we were close to coming to a breakthrough, and that we would just never know the outcome. And it seemed kind of tragic. But I basically was talking with everyone about how we shut down the lab and how we could work from home. My co-founder came out and said, you know, there's this exception 10B in the ordinance that allows us to continue working on, like, our interpretation was a narrow one, which is like critical medical projects. But I didn't want to demand that of anyone. And so what I did is I talked to some of the people that were working, and I said, specifically around the COVID-19 project, on a voluntary basis, why don't you go home, talk to your families, and see whether you'd be willing to come in and keep working on that. And if we don't have enough people that all agree to do it, I won't say I won't tell everyone else who said no. I'll just say we don't have a consensus and we just won't do it. And so I went home that night feeling pretty defeated, like we had gotten close, and then we were kind of being stopped by the shutdown working on the thing that could fix the shutdown, right? So it was a very frustrating scenario. And then I woke up to the morning to an army, because my people, they all contacted me. They're like, Jake, no, we're doing this. And they basically, all of them stood up, and we worked in shifts. So we didn't have too many people at the lab at once. We added like additional protective gear, and we had morning shifts that started at 7 until like the next night at 2 a.m. And we were able to kind of all coordinate around a single project. And most of our clients were really patient. We had a couple that were griping about the deadlines, but I'm like, sorry, man, like the building's literally being scrubbed right now. And we were able to blast through just an incredible amount of engineering very quickly. And I'm extremely happy to report over the weekend that we got the results back, that we had succeeded on. I was going to be happy if any one of those six arms resulted in a drug. And we did all six to make sure that we'd achieve success and we had redundancy. And instead, we have affinity matured, crossed, high affinity blocking clones on all six arms. So really, at this point, we have a luxury of riches to pick what is the absolute best molecule we can choose as the best therapeutic to carry forward. And that's where we are now.
For those people who are not taking this seriously, give us your best pitch to them.
Yeah, so this is not like the flu. There are some things about this that are different. First off, it's much more severe in some cases. And the second is that it can leave lung scarring, so fibrosis in the lungs or honeycombing on subjects who get quite sick. And it's not clear how long that takes to heal. So it's not like the flu where it sucks, but you'll be over in 7 days. You may have a longer term problem of getting full lung function back. And so it's risks like that where I just ask you to take it seriously and wait rather than say, oh, let's just get this over with, or maybe it won't affect me that much. And I think if you do that for us, first off, I'll thank you. Many other people will thank you, and you'll end up thanking yourself later, because you can live in a healthier body in the future once we get through this.
Well, I want to thank you and your team for braving the shutdown and working on this, because I hope that you go down in history and your teammates with names like Jonas Salk and Walter Reed, because we need you, man.
I feel very humbled to be able to work with such remarkable people, and the successes that we have achieved are because of them. So thank you. I'll pass that on to them.
That was Dr. Jacob Glanville. He runs the biotech company Distributed Bio in the Bay Area. In January, he was featured on the Netflix documentary series Pandemic. Now, in the pandemic we're living in, he's potentially created a cure for COVID-19. He was interviewed by NSPR's Dave Schlom. And that's your program for Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. Again, we want you to drive this coverage. Let us know what stories you want to hear and what news you need to know. Call our message line at 433-9216. That's 433-9216. Or you can head to our website, mynspr.org. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Special thanks to Dave Schlom, and last night to Kim Weir. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. We're back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay vigilant. But know there's possibly some hope in sight.